Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Folly Coffee Podcast. If you haven't done so already, I ask that real quick here, you just pause, go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, and if you've liked any of the previous episodes or this episode, please give us that five-star rating. It helps us greatly. Thank you, and enjoy this episode. Hey, this is Rob. This is episode 97 of the Folly Coffee Podcast. Let's get it brewing. All right. I am here with easily our best dressed guest. We're 97 episodes in, and I can say that with confidence, Jason DeRusha. So I'm just going to list the accolades here because I think your career is so cool with what you're doing. You are a morning news anchor at WCCO, food editor and restaurant critic for Minnesota Monthly Magazine, part-time host on the WCCO radio show, 9 Emmy Awards. I did not know this one. James Beard nominee, which is amazing. You've been awarded Best Newscaster, Most Influential People in the Twin Cities. You've got this massive Twitter and Instagram following. But the one that caught my eye the most in kind of reading about your career is the city of Minneapolis named September 21st Jason DeRusha Day.
That's right. One day only. It doesn't repeat. So although a lot of people choose to commemorate. I mean, that's their choice.
I want to start on that because I am really curious about how does that happen that you get a day named after you in the city of Minneapolis?
Well, you have to decide if you really want to be disillusioned as to the process behind an official day being named. It seems like it. So this came back years ago. I did a segment called Good Question for our 10 o'clock news.
Yep.
And one of the questions that we were answering is, how do you get an official day? And the answer is that official days are mostly BS. It's straight up marketing nonsense where you pay. There's like this nationaldaycalendar.com. And whoever created this thing is a freaking genius, right? So this person created the National Day Calendar. So you pay whatever, $1,000 or whatever it is. But some local marketing firms talked about how they would like lobby the state legislature for their clients to get like National Agriculture Day or Minnesota Corn Day. So I'm like, well, this would be funny. Well, actually, it wasn't even my idea. There were a couple articles done on this back in the day. Some of my Twitter followers were like, well, aren't you going to get your own day when I posted what I was working a story on? And so some people started campaigning for it where they put up this ridiculous photo of me wearing Zubas for pants and a suit on top. I know all you guys think you created that during the pandemic in Zoom, but I had the party on the bottom, business on top look going a long time ago. But people were posting this photo and saying, Jason DeRusha Day. And so the mayor at the time, R.T. Ryback, did in fact declare it Jason DeRusha Day.
It's almost like you hear that you can buy a star and name it after someone.
That's right.
Or I learned this with Guinness Book of World Records because I was like, we need a world record. And right? I looked into that, and that's the explanation as to why so many world records are totally random and bogus, is because companies come in and pay a huge fee and then say, hey, we now hold the world record for this or that. And you're like, why does that exist? And
it's great publicity, right?
Well, I'd be lying if I'm not immediately going to look into how to get a day
after
this conversation.
What was funny is I live in the suburb of Maple Grove here in the Twin Cities, and I went to the town I live in and asked them if they would declare a Jason DeRusha Day, because I thought it was more likely I could get Maple Grove population, 58,000 people, to declare Jason DeRusha Day versus the city of Minneapolis. But Maple Grove is like, no. It's a hard and fast no. So I'm very grateful to R.T. Ryback, because that is one of... And then we threw a big party. We had a party to celebrate Jason DeRusha Day.
That's amazing.
It was very fun.
Well, I've got it in my calendar now. Yes, it's definitely going to be a new Folly Coffee celebration for Jason DeRusha Day every year. Well, and I also want to start off and just say, one thing I respect about you and love about what you do is how you hype small business, especially in the Twin Cities. Because I will tell you straight up that when we were early on in 2018... you know, just a couple of guys doing some random coffee thing and me having quit my job and living with my parents at 27 years old. It's kind of this thing where you go, gosh, is this like, and seeing, I sent you some coffee just because I was a fan of what you do in the food world. And just you posting that alone as a a brand new business, seeing that, that's one of those early moments that is engraved in my brain. Is like, oh, it's real. Like, this is a real thing now. And seeing you continue to do that, especially being a coffee drinker, I see a lot of my friends who are roasters, you posting what they're doing. Those types of things are so awesome for business owners and be able to bring awareness, not to mention that your credibility is very high with the work you do. And that's what I want to get into, because I think sometimes you see someone, you're like, oh, this is what they do. And if someone were to ask me, what exactly does Jason DeRusha do? It's like, well, he's, you know, he is the morning host on WCCO. But actually, the thing that I follow closest with what you do is your food. I guess you would call it critiquing.
Yeah, I suppose,
your food
right?
Critic work in Minnesota Monthly is probably the thing I follow most. Your lists are some of the most followed lists. I know, like, during the pandemic, you had a list of all the carryout, and that was, like, my go-to thing for where I was getting food locally. And so it's and meanwhile, you've got this massive Twitter and Instagram following behind all these things that you're doing. But before we get to that, I want to start before your career on air and kind of what led you and what does that path look like to be able to become a morning host like you are doing currently?
So I feel very lucky. From a young age, I knew that I wanted to be a broadcaster. I knew, my parents will say that I knew when I was like in second grade. So from a very young age, I was like interviewing people with my little, you know, I'm 46 years old. So this is in the 1980s. I'd be walking around with an old toy that was called a Mr. Microphone. And the Mr. Microphone had a radio antenna on the bottom of it. And you could tune your FM radio to like 87.7. and talk into this microphone and it would come out of the radio. And I just thought this was the most amazing thing ever. I'm broadcasting in my basement to no one, but it was, you know, your voice coming out of the radio.
It's almost like what I'm doing here.
Yeah, it's very similar. It's an early form of podcasting.
Broadcasting to no one.
In your basement to no one. But I just loved talking to people and I liked telling stories and finding out about stuff. So from a young age, I knew I wanted to do this. I didn't know if I wanted to do radio or what exactly. And, you know, I was the morning announcement guy in my high school. We had a high school radio station. I grew up in suburban Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so we had a real FM radio station. So we did, this was before like the regional sports networks were broadcasting everything every high school did. So in my high school, when our girls basketball team went to the state tournament, we were it. 90.5 FM was the only radio station that was going to cover it. So we got to go down with the team and all this. So it was, so I did this in high school. I went to Marquette University in college. I studied broadcast and electronic communication was what they called the major then. And so it just was, I knew I wanted to do this, and I ended up in TV. Largely because my college had a worse radio station than my high school had. So I was like, well, this is dumb. I already did this. So we had a student-run TV station at Marquette. And a lot of colleges, and I think this is so dumb, where you have to be a junior before you really can get involved in your major. But at Marquette, anyone could be in the student TV station. It was just like a club, like anything else. So as a freshman, you came in and they were like, well, run a camera. And I'm like, I don't know how to run a camera. And another kid taught me how to run a camera. And then another kid taught me how to edit videotape. And another kid taught me how to be a reporter. And then I got older and I taught other kids how to do all this stuff. And we were just teaching each other. And then I did all sorts of internships. So, you know, I interned at the local TV station in Milwaukee. I interned at ABC News in New York. I interned at a one-room tiny TV station in Rockford, Illinois. So all of that kind of had me ready for the first job in Davenport, Iowa.
And so when you graduate, what is that process like? Where, so at this point, have you decided I want to be an anchor or I want to do TV? How does that process look when you graduate?
I wanted to be a TV reporter, and the way it works in, it's a weird way to find a job, right? Because what you do is you give an audition tape. So when I was, now it's much easier now where you can just send like a YouTube link.
Yeah.
But when I was looking for my first job in 1997, we had to send VHS tapes out to news directors. So I would be dubbing tapes, you know, have two VHS tapes, machines hooked up to each other to dub tapes. And then I would send these all over the country. And it was so expensive and you never knew if anyone was going to watch it or anything. And that's how you look for a job. So my first job was sort of random, where I sent a tape and they watched it and called me for an interview and offered me a job the next day.
What were the steps from Davenport to bring you to the Twin Cities?
Davenport was first. I was a reporter for about 6 months, and then I became the weekend anchor. You know, and in small newsrooms, people just kind of move up, and then you're there, and you move up. And so I was the weekend anchor. And then I went to Milwaukee, back to Milwaukee, the station I interned at. So the anchor, the 10 o'clock anchor at that station in Milwaukee, was my mentor. And so one day the news director walked into his office and was like, I need a 10 o'clock reporter. And he had my tape on his desk and is like, you should hire Jason. And she hired me. So that was that. And then my job here.
Did you know that that tape was there or that they had it on hand?
No, I knew Jerry, my mentor, had the tape because I just sent him some stuff to critique. And then, but I didn't know that process was happening. It just, there it was. And then I got a call and there it is. So kind of crazy how that happened. But it really is networking, right? Yeah. So like because I interned at that station, I had the connections. And then I got hired here I've been here for 18 years now. I thought I was going to be here for 5 years and on to the next thing. And instead, we've made a home here. So this job I got I was visiting town and I asked to visit with the news directors. And I visited with the news director at Channel 4, where their website said there was a job opening. And I'm like, this is awesome. Like, I'm meeting with the news director. They have a reporter opening. And I go into her office so like excited. And we sit down and she's like, well, I don't have any job openings. And I was like, what? It said on your website. She's like, oh, it always says that. There wasn't a real opening. And I was like, well, could you look at my tape and like send me some feedback? If you like it, if you hate it, I'd love to know. And that was about it. We spent less than 10 minutes together. I didn't get a tour of the station, nothing. In her office. And then I was out on Nicollet Mall, like, what just happened? This was nothing. But by the time I got home, I had an email from the news director where she said, this is the best live shot, live reporting tape I've ever seen.
Really?
And then she said, and I still don't have a job opening. But a month later, she did. And then I just got hired. I hadn't even seen the station or met anyone. It's so funny now, because our TV station, when they bring in someone for an interview, you know, it's like you're applying to be like, you know, the Secretary of the Treasury. It's 1 million interviews. You have to meet with everyone who works there. I'm sure they all weigh in on it. Whereas I didn't even get a tour of the station. I met no one. I was there for like 10 minutes and then I was hired.
What do you think has changed in the landscape of like media that has created this change in the interview process?
I think it's just general corporate America, right? Yeah. Like the interview process is just ridiculous. Instead of just trusting your gut of like this, you know, I think it's so expensive to hire someone, right? Just the process and bringing people out. So, you know, managers are risk averse. I mean, that is very corporate America. And so they take forever.
Yeah, my first job working for Sam Adams out of college, I think it was a total of 5 interview rounds.
You're like, are you kidding?
And some like, people are like, oh, you're going to sell beer. That sounds neat. I was like, the interview process was intense.
Right. And do you think that results in better candidates?
That's an interesting question. So for me personally, I think that sales jobs, yes, no. Because especially with sales jobs where that specific type where I'm hitting 10 to 12 accounts every single day, half of it is people drop out because they're like, this is too many rounds of interviews. Yeah. So you kind of need someone
interesting
that has the persistence to say, I'm going to keep coming back and keep coming back and keep interviewing. And also, all 5 rounds were with different people. So it is one of those things where like it starts with just a general person and it gets more specific to which role you might take. But I think part of the interview process with that was just like persistence.
Yeah.
Is if the salesperson is going to
see
come
if
back.
You give up or not.
And,
interesting.
And if someone drops out halfway through because they're like, I have this other job offer, then you're like, oh, well, then you're not compelled enough to be here to not accept that.
Yeah.
So on
go
and
take
so
it.
Forth.
Interesting. Yeah.
Now, as this is going along, you have this, what is now a really highly engaged, big social media following on both Twitter and Instagram. Is that something that you saw emerging and you wanted to incorporate into what you're doing? Or was that more of an organic reach that kind of just grew on its own?
Totally organic. Mm. Like, I have always been into kind of digital future stuff. So I remember in college being on, you know, news groups is what we called them. So you, whatever, you know, alt.tv.game shows would be one news group that I was on, or like the Letterman news group, where you'd be talking with different fans. So these were old, like today, I guess those conversations, very similar to Reddit, I guess, like mm-hmm. Reddit, where it's not a very fancy computer, interface or anything. It's just text and people commenting, and that was it.
That came to mind was the Reddit.
Yeah, Reddit is the news group of today, for sure. But back then, it was, you know, it was a smaller group. But I just always was into that. And so when Facebook became available for people who were not in college, well, I had a Facebook account, like, through an alumni email address because I just wanted to experiment with it. Like, I've just – so it mostly, like, Twitter, when it started – was just like me and my friends, like finding out, like, oh, what are you doing tonight? It really was that. It was like, what bar is everyone at? And that's where you'd go. So I always did it because it was fun. I've never done it because I thought, like, oh, this would help my work. And I think that's part of why, now, not that that's the only way to do it, right? But it's part of why I've had success in building a following is because I'm not doing it. It's not like a cynical ploy to try to get more clout or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I enjoy engaging with people. I enjoy mixing it up. I enjoy the fact that, you know, especially think about this. Like, I'm, as a member of the media, I'm going to make mistakes. All of us make mistakes in whatever our job is. But the real judge, the real metric of being a successful leader is how do you respond when something goes wrong? Mm. And so in this community, you have people telling you, like, hey, I think that's wrong. You're like, how awesome is that? These are unpaid people, like, just trying to help make the product better because they care about the broader community getting the accurate information. Like, that's pretty amazing. So people could reach out to me and be like, hey, I think that person's name is John, not Jim. And you're like, oh, let me fix that. Or, oh, you guys said this, and I don't think that's right, and I would fix it. And so I sort of became like the WCCO information desk, where I was answering people's questions but also like just sharing what I thought was fun. Mm-hmm. And it's been crazy to watch it grow.
And it does give it a much more human aspect to what you do, because sometimes you see a media personality, especially somebody like an anchor, and you're like, oh, that's the person on the TV that tells me the news every morning. Yeah. But then to be able to connect with you on Twitter or Instagram and see what you're doing in your personal life, to see the new restaurants you're trying, to see what just... obviously, you're dressed very well, and so to see any, like, new fashion, and like, your wine selections are something that I know a lot of people follow, and follow your stories for that type of thing, and it just creates, it makes you realize that the people reporting, like, are human, and so what you said about making mistakes is, I think it creates an overall more, like, genuine, like, more human approach to what it is you're doing. Yeah. I've said the word human like eight times, but that's because it's kind of bizarre even just having you sitting here talking to you person to person, because in high school, I was watching you on TV. Every morning when I got up for Lyft in the morning where I was like, how is this person up now?
Right.
And seeing you on the TV to now being able to talk to you person to person, it's a really interesting, cool, but kind of odd experience in a way.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I'm fascinated that I've been doing Twitter, I think, for, I don't know, 13 years or something like that. And on the one hand, it's a little surprising that media people aren't better at it. Like, if you were to make a list of people, sports people are usually pretty good at it, because in sports, you can kind of run that line between, like, sharing your opinion, but not being accused of, like, oh, you're in the tank for the Twins? Like, I don't know. Whereas as a news person, it's a little more scary, right?
Interesting.
So if I express, what I've always done is express very strong opinions about things that wouldn't, well, I usually describe it as I express extremely strong opinions about things that extremely do not matter in the scheme of things. So you're never going to hear my opinion on politics, but you will hear me call out BS or failures. So, like, I think you can, there are things you can objectively state in plain language, and people are sometimes astonished by that. But if I ever express something that smells like an opinion in the political realm, it's because it's a reported fact.
Mm-hmm.
So you can say, like, all right, if I said that it was a failure, oh, I called something a failure, and another local news person texted me and was like, that was bold. And I said, I'm like, it's a failure, though. Like, it's not, I'm not saying what the better policy would be, but no matter how you look at it, this was a failure. And he was like, that's fair. Like, you're like, that's a good point. So I think you have to be careful, because I know, especially younger people, I think, are used to having news coverage that aligns with their perspective, right? So if you're conservative, you like Fox News or Newsmax, you know which newspapers you read. If you're liberal, you watch MSNBC, and now CNN, I think, has gone from being down the middle to certainly a lot more opinion mm-hmm. on that channel. And so people just watch what they already believe. And I think there's value into having, especially in a local media market, people who are not, you don't know what they think. I don't know what I think about a lot of these things. I would have a hard time figuring out how I would line up politically, but I'm always trying to cheer for the people.
Yeah.
And right? So, like, I'm not on any politician's side. I want this community to be great. That's all.
And that's a really interesting point, because you're seeing more and more of that with the media, is this growing, like, intensity and so much anger around yeah. media, especially when it's because I think it's like one side or the other yeah. on the national networks.
Yeah.
And then you can get yourself into this echo chamber of, if I'm only watching exactly what aligns with me, then how could anybody else think a point on the other side? Because I'm seeing all these,
right?
I mean, I flip through the channels, and if I switch from like ESPN to any of the major national news at work, I go, this is the same style of conversation where it's like, it's like, I don't know if I'm watching the debate about is LeBron or MJ the GOAT, or if I'm watching debate about the presidential election that's yeah. coming up. And versus what you're saying is reporting of the news, yeah. especially on a local level, it seems to be radically different than what's happening on like the entertainment side yeah. on a national level.
That's such a smart observation, that it is a very similar stylistically to what you would see in a sports debate, in a sports show. And it's because those things are fun to watch. But like debating whether LeBron or Michael Jordan is the GOAT, like, it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter.
And that's the most alarming part.
Right. But it's fun. Like, I mean, I grew up in Chicago, right? Like, those, you know, that was my childhood, those Michael Jordan years. So it's no debate to me. Clearly Michael Jordan is the GOAT. But, you know, I don't know that it's great to turn, look, there's room for lots of media, right? So there's plenty of room for partisan media. And sometimes partisan media does some great reporting mm-hmm. that ends up in kind of the nonpartisan media. You know, I understand the theory, and I'm open to it, to discussion about it, the idea that all of us have biases. So the idea of like having an unbiased media is kind of a joke. And I would say that there's some fairness to that we all have biases. But part of the benefit of having, you know, like local media who lives in your community is that I get paid, all of us, all the reporters, we get paid every day. We don't have to hustle for clicks or clickbait or whatever. We get paid every day to go out and to try to bury our biases and to cover something, or at least be aware of what they are and make sure you give the story a fair shake. And so to me, that's what it's always about, like being fair. And also, it's very powerful to, and this is true in media, it's true in business, to always be open to the possibility that what you think about something is wrong.
Yeah, the lack of tying yourself to your belief. And
It's so hard for people.
It's hard, but I think the further you can separate who you are and your identity as a person from your beliefs, I think it's more important to say, this is who I am. This is what I believe currently. And that's what
I like that.
I tell everyone I meet, it's like, I love to have my mind changed, because that means information was presented to me that was better than what I currently held, as opposed to being presented information and going, how do I argue back on this? And
it is something I love about social media, because oftentimes, if you know, you have to filter out all the garbage. But when you have someone who's not a bad actor, who's trying to engage in like a genuine way, at least once a week, someone makes me think about something in a new way.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing for a free website, right?
Yeah.
It's not bad.
It's like the whole joke is like, how is this app free? This yeah. is crazy.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how media develops long term, because I think just like the nature of the national networks being entertainment almost, and yeah. it's so hard to capture attention that they feel they need to ramp it up and like focus on their audience more. I'm burnt out on it. And so if I want to seek out news, I'm trying to seek who isn't on one side or yeah. like who's getting the news directly. Just this is what's happening, which is like, that's what reporting is.
Yeah.
And that's interesting to be in your position where you have your own personal beliefs.
Sure.
You have your own personal biases reporting on stories. And I think that's, I mean, I tune into WCCO for the George Floyd coverage of the result trial.
Yeah.
And I was extremely impressed that you were able to cover it in such like an accurate, but in a way that this is what's happening. We're talking to people in the streets, what they believe, and that I think provides a much more accurate picture of what's happening versus here's our narrative. What can we do to support that and the way we report that?
And yeah, yeah, that was an amazing experience. And trying to cover that trial particularly, where, you know, all of us who live here, you know, we had our ideas. We saw the tape. We knew what we thought. But I went into that coverage, and I covered every second of that trial. We aired it on our digital streaming network. And I went into the experience like a juror. So I wanted to really be open to anything and just sit there and take it in and think about it like a juror might think about it. And it was a very interesting experience. And then being there for the verdict, where you just, I mean, you think about the verdict in a criminal trial. Is there a similar moment of drama? I don't know. I don't think there is. That moment where there is finality that will be announced, but you don't know. And so I had my guesses as to what I thought the jury would come back with, but I also had no idea. So you're sitting there as the judge reads the jury's verdict and, you know, guilty, guilty, guilty. It was amazing. It's like, here's this moment. We don't know. And we waited for 45 minutes of coverage, I think, before, mm-hmm. between when we knew there was a verdict and yeah. when it actually happened. And so it was fascinating.
And that has to be such a challenge with such an emotionally yeah. charged topic to stay neutral, despite, I'm sure, personal beliefs and opinions are infused for everybody on your team.
Sure.
But to have to take that, and that's also... that the coverage of that was so emotionally charged that I imagine no matter how you cover it, there's going to be people that are telling you you're doing it wrong. But to be able to stay and report the facts on something that could very easily turn one way or another, and that is something that's got to be very challenging to do, especially when you see coverage of events happening in such a one way or the other kind of way.
Well, I'll give you an example. So before the conviction, many political leaders were talking about the murder of George Floyd, and most people were calling it the murder of George Floyd. George Floyd was murdered. I never said those words because Derek Chauvin was accused of murder. Mm. This was a very unusual case because in most cases, there's no question as to whether or not a murder had occurred. The question is who did it, right? Think of most murder trials. Mm. You know someone was shot. You know they were murdered. So who did it is the focus. In this case, we knew who did it. The question was it murder? So until there was a conviction, I always said the death of George Floyd. George Floyd died. Well, people were very upset about that. Mm. So people would be like, why won't you call it a murder? You're pro cop. Why won't you call? I'm like, well, we don't know if it's a murder. We know. I saw the video. I'm like, well, I respect that view, but I am a journalist. Like, I can't call it that. And they're like, well, what about OJ? He's a murderer. I'm like, well, you know what? We've never called OJ a murderer because he was found not guilty. And whether you think he did it or not is up to you. But as a journalist, I can't say that. So I don't know. You try to stay focused on what you know. You try to remember that individual words matter.
Yeah.
And some people don't care, and that's all right. Like, you're never going to make everybody happy. A lot of the people who complain the loudest don't actually watch any of our product. And that's an interesting byproduct of this age, where people are reacting to what you tweet or what you don't tweet. You're like, gosh, I always thought this was just like a spare gig, but people are just like something I was doing for fun. Like, I don't think the workplace pays me to tweet. So that's interesting too, where people Twitter like it's reported.
Now there's probably specific demographics and age that your Twitter and Instagram is a far bigger news source.
100%.
And that is
maybe they've never seen me on the news, but they know my Instagram
and
or know
that's
my Twitter.
Wild to think mm-hmm. about that all of a sudden there's this blurring of this is your Twitter and Instagram, but yeah. you're reporting the news, so you are a reporter, and so that's got to be a very tricky line. And
it makes me more aware of like what I retweet, yeah. what I say, what, you know, there are certain things that we've learned aren't very good uses of social media. So like if you're covering a protest and live tweeting as you go, we used to think like that was useful for people. But now I think we look at that and wonder, are we being too one-sided by like tweeting what roads are closed or what the police are saying, and you're not tweeting kind of what the message is or what the reason is, and you get focused on the breaking news instead of the bigger picture. So like these are things we're thinking about all the time.
Yeah, and that's got to be a difficult thing in truly bipartisan reporting. It's just something as important but small detail as word selection. I imagine that could be the type of thing that if you start not thinking about that could be how these national news networks end up being totally on one side because of the engagement they see when they start to slide.
Maybe, And it's the difference in, like, it's the benefit of having paid journalists where it's your job, where we, like, these things are hard, but this is our job to think about this stuff. Like, this is what we do.
And versus needing clicks to get paid, and then you're incentivized to which side is clicking the most, which stories, and then you're almost incentivized to create controversy because then you're going to potentially get more click through on your, if you're a personal Instagram reporter or something.
And that's okay too, right? Like just because everyone who's pushing a story has an agenda. It doesn't necessarily mean that the story is not valid.
Yeah.
So, like, that's part of what a professional reporter has to kind of suss out, you know?
Yeah, and then this is my personal opinion, but it's like most people are very good at sniffing out what is real and what isn't. But the thing is there's a small percentage of people, and they're the ones commenting on everything. So you might see a post, see it has all these comments, and be like, this must be how most people feel.
Right.
But most people, the way they engage on social media, they follow who they want to follow. They see a post, probably aren't even liking it. They go, oh, I see that. I'm going to continue following them because I like this.
Yeah.
And then the people that are commenting are very intensely emotional one way or another. And so I think it's like when it comes to reporting, most people end up following the people that they think are doing the best job.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think you're right that most people come at this like from a good perspective.
Yeah.
Where they're just doing their best to find out what information is going on. And there is, you know, a small but vocal minority, you know, don't read the comments sections. It's not usually great, which is kind of a bummer. Like I used to have this idea that the beauty of the internet is the fact it's kind of the Wikipedia theory that the wisdom of the crowd will make good knowledge rise to the top.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, what's happened is the ability to manipulate the crowd allows all sorts of misinformation to rise to the top. So I was sort of naive, and I think a lot of the early founders of the internet were too, in thinking that this kind of power of the crowd could be used for good. But instead, we've seen certainly with, you know, Russia kind of trying to mess with our elections and stuff like that. You're like, huh, I guess the power of the crowd can easily be manipulated for evil as well.
And Facebook being explicitly told, hey, your algorithm is pretty much tuned into promoting negativity.
Hate speech and negative. They're like, well, that's what people
it's
like.
It's the algorithm.
It's interesting.
The one you created, you mean? But so I want to move on because not like I've mentioned already, but you're also food editor for the Minnesota Monthly Magazine. So how do you go from being a morning anchor to landing a gig as food editor for Minnesota Monthly?
Well, at the time I was just a reporter, not just a reporter, but I was a reporter, and I ended up on this judging panel. I was like the TV station's representative judging the Minnesota Monthly Food and Wine Show Chef Challenge. And so I was sitting next to the food editor, who now is with Minneapolis St. Paul magazine, Dara Moskowitz Grumdahl. And Dara gave me my first shot at food writing. She was judging with me and thought like, oh, Jason sort of seems to know what he's talking about. And I only knew about food as an eater, right? It's what my wife and I do for fun. Like, we don't go to movies and we only occasionally go to concerts. And so we mostly go out to eat. So Dara asked if I wanted to write reviews. And I was like, I don't know. Do I want to write reviews? And I said, well, sure, I'll try. I asked Andrew Zimmern. I'm like, Andrew, what do you think about this? He's like, just say yes. Like, if you don't like it, then stop doing it. Mm-hmm. I was like, all right, I'll say yes. Which is actually not bad advice for anyone. Right?
Like, I was going to say, that's some great advice.
Like,
there.
Just say yes, but like, be ready to pull the plug if you hate it. You're like, that's pretty good. All right. I was like, all right, Andrew. So I said yes. And that's what started it. So I had a Twitter account focused on food because, you know, it is funny how social media has changed. When some of this stuff started, if you were tweeting or updating Facebook about your vacation, it used to be seen as like, ugh. Don't rub it in that you're on vacation while I'm not.
Yeah.
Now I think people love that content because it helps them either dream or plan their own vacation.
Yeah, now there are people that go on vacations for
content. That's a gig. Like, my gosh, I could be doing way more fun stuff. But I went on a wine trip to Napa Valley years ago. And I created a new account because I didn't want to annoy. I'm sure there were like 100 followers. I don't know how many followers I was worried about not annoying. But I started a new account just to chronicle the wine trip. And when I came back, I thought, I'm like, well, I don't drink that much. Like, how am I going to run a wine account? So let's call it DeRussia Eats instead of DeRussia Wine. Mm. And so then it's, you know, now there's, I don't know how many people are following it, 20,000 or something. And it's become, now I'm the main critic for Minnesota Monthly Magazine. So it's been really fun. I come at it. I'm not a chef. I'm not a cook. Mm-hmm. I'm not a restaurant owner. I'm just someone who loves to go out to eat. And I kind of came at it like a journalist, like I wanted to learn more about it. But I'm always writing for the eater. Like, I don't care about the chef. I don't care about the restaurant. Well, I do. I want to have a rich local food scene, but I'm writing for people who are going out to eat.
And so what year did you start that whole partnership?
I think I first started writing. It's been more than 10 years now, so it's been a long time. So I had a little trip in between where I went over and worked for Minneapolis St. Paul magazine, but I've been writing about food for more than a decade now.
And what's the Twin Cities food and drink scene? How's it changed in the past 10 years since you've been doing it?
Oh, it's social media has changed the pressure on places to be good from day one. Mm. And the other thing that's happened is there are fewer professional reviewers out there. So there's more people than ever delivering food content. You can follow a million Instagram food accounts, a million influencers, and they're great. I love what they do. But, the number of full-time, I mean, I'm not full-time, so I don't devote the time. You know, in the old school, you'd have 3 visits before you write a review. And now I think Rick Nelson is the only one who's doing that. And frankly, Rick hasn't written a review since before the pandemic. So it's, I think that's unfortunate. I do think we have far more international flavors and ethnic influences on our food than we had a decade ago. So in some ways we've gotten more adventurous, but in other ways I would say we've actually gotten more conservative in the style of restaurant that we want. So we've always been a market that is sort of humble. So like, you don't have the super fine dining foodie type places here because Minnesotans love steakhouses. So when you think about special occasion dining in many cities, it would be like the fine dining, best chef, artsy fartsy tweezer stuff, cool food, kind of the stuff you think of as like a picture that would be on a magazine.
Yeah.
And here people go to Manny's or Murray's or Jack's Cafe or Mancini's like that, or the St. Paul Grill. That's where we go.
If I'm going out for a nice meal, I want to be overly stuffed full, that's too. Right. If I'm going to spend this much money, I got to be stuffed at the end of it and make it worth
it. I need a 48-ounce steak.
We're in Minnesota where if you compliment me on something I'm wearing or holding, I have to tell you how much I saved on
it. It's 100%
true. So if I'm going to go out for a nice dinner, I got to be extremely overly full.
And we also have this weird phenomenon that we are way more suburban than most people think of. So most of your kind of corporate upper level folks who would have the money to really support a really good food scene, a lot of them go back to their homes near Lake Minnetonka or Woodbury or North Oaks or whatever. And so the money in this town, I think in general, doesn't support the kind of high end fine dining scene the way you would expect. So what do we have now? An obsession with burgers and pizza in this town. Like, you can be a great restaurant, a great chef, and if you don't have a burger that people are Instagramming about, forget it. Like, you've failed.
That is a really, really good point, because it, I mean, it's so funny because you see the work that, like, Gavin, Kaysen, and Chef Ann Kim are doing in the high end, you know, Suki and Mimi, Ann Kim's restaurant, and Demi with what Gavin is doing. And really, where they're raising the most awareness, especially with younger, is, Chef Ann Kim's pizza, Young Joni, Pizzeria Lola, and Gavin with the burger at I used to work at Belcour when it was still open, the dirty French burger. Like, that's what see the most pictures of.
Right.
And that's a really interesting point. Do you think that type of thing of having an amazing burger or pizza and doing it at a really high level, do you think that attracts someone to want to try the rest of their cuisine and potentially attract them to the high end? Or do you think that's two totally separate consumers and they're, you see two totally separate demographics going to those two different types of places?
I don't think it works to attract them. I think it keeps the restaurants in business so they can keep cranking out the cool stuff, right? Yeah. So, which is fine. Like, I think that's fine. Like, we sometimes in this town struggle to come to terms with what we are versus what we dream that we are.
Yeah, like Jorge over at Petit Leon, and like, here's the burger.
Here it is.
Here's what I'm really, really pumped about making over here. Yeah. And then you try the burger and you go, well, this is one of the best burgers.
It's pretty great. It's pretty great. St. Dinette, which is an amazing restaurant in St. Paul, has a killer burger. The rest of their menu is super exciting and really great. I mean, the chef there is one of the most talented chefs in the Twin Cities. But if you want to keep the lights on, you have to have a burger. And so is that bad? I don't think so. It's just that's what people want. And giving them the best version of what people want, I think that's noble. I think that's fine. But as a food writer, you sort of are like, another burger. Great. Like, but that's what people want to know about. So, like, I'm not going to give you a list of the top 10 steak tartares in the Twin Cities, although that might be useful to a very minor and limited group of people.
I was going to say, I'd be all in for that
list. But, like, the top 10 burgers, people are going to go nuts over, is fine.
Do you think that's a pretty distinctly Minnesota or Twin Cities type of phenomenon, or Midwest potentially?
I think we're a little more obsessed with burgers than other places, but not hugely. Like, I think the biggest thing that we struggle with is that our population is a little smaller. We don't have the business travel. I mean, one thing the pandemic taught us for people who weren't really paying attention to the business of restaurants is just how much, like, business expense accounts keep a lot of our restaurants going. So you look at Belcour, where you worked, like, I mean, who do you think, when you looked at a table that was ordering $800 worth of wine, like, that was a corporate card that was coming out to pay for that meal. And so I love to go out to eat, but my wife and I, and we have a nice living, but we're not going to go out and order three, you know, $200 bottles of wine. We're just not. And so those expensive bottles of wine help allow restaurants to, you know, sell a super fancy locally sourced morel mushroom dish for $24 when it really should probably cost $34. But they're like, well, no one's going to buy this for $34.
That's a really interesting insight.
But we'll just sell a couple more high-end bottles of wine and we're all good. Like, that's sort of how it works.
And it's, that's interesting that it's not so much the local the local people that are driving the high-end restaurants, but the business people that are coming in or the work that is being done in that area.
And maybe it's a local person bringing clients out or something, but it is a lot of business travel. And you look at very busy restaurants that, you know, shut down during the pandemic. Look at all the restaurants that shut down during the pandemic. Not nearly as many as I expected would shut down, but it almost wiped out the kind of four-star fine dining area.
It'll be,
what's left besides Gavin at Spoon and Stable? But you lost Bachelor Farmer 4 stars. You lost Butcher and the Boar, which was a 4-star steakhouse.
Belcour.
Like that's a lot of high quality stuff that got wiped out because there's no business travel and no events.
And I wonder if people's appreciation for not only just the food that's being prepared, but the atmosphere, there may be a heightened sense as to the overall package. Because that's when it comes to really fine dining, that's a big part of it. Yeah. That you for just eating in Spoon and Stable, the second you walk into, the second you leave,
what
everything
room, right?
is immaculate.
Yeah.
From the just even speaking to the host, and you're like, that service was amazing. And that will be intriguing to see how the appreciation for going out returns now that we're back at capacity.
Yeah, I think you're going to see two things. I think the rich people got richer, and the rich people who got richer during the pandemic are going to want to be taken care of. So really great service, really great room is going to be important, and they're going to be willing to pay for it. Mm. On the flip side, I think the younger diner expects high design. And so I think the kind of fast food, the national fast food template for this is Smashburger. So Smashburger has a pretty cool looking restaurant, right? Like it looks modern. It looks nice enough maybe for a first date. Like, you know, it's not too intimidating, but it's, you know, you can get a beer there. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to see more of that on a local level. Like My Burger, I think, is a good example of a local chain that's high design. The room looks cool, and the burgers are good. And you think, you know, Red Cow is another example of a pretty approachable, casual restaurant. But they make their money by selling a ton of craft beer, beautiful wine, and cocktails. And you're like, smart. So I think we'll see more of that. You're going to see a lot of it in chicken. People are like obsessed with fried chicken sandwiches.
Fried chicken right now.
So that'll be, I bet you see half a dozen kind of fast casual chicken spots open in the next year.
It's almost becoming in that mix of the burger, pizza, now hot chicken.
Yeah, the chicken sandwich for sure. That is in that.
Yeah. And the thing is, I'm kind of here for it.
I love it, man. I love it. And the Popeye's chicken sandwich is legit. Like, you know, find me a better $4 sandwich. Yeah. Like, and I'd like to hear about it. I don't think you're going to find it.
Yeah. And I've had Kamal on over at Nashville Coop and their hot chicken. And then you see Justin's opening side chick over in Uptown. And I'd be lying if I said I'm not going to try every hot chicken sandwich that I can find.
Yeah, it is fun. Like the spice thing is another thing that's new here in town. And I know you guys have your hot sauce, which is, I think it's fantastic.
Thank you.
It's really, really good because it's heat, but you really get the coffee flavor in there.
It's about 30% brewed coffee in there.
Yeah, it's intense, right? Yeah. But like, here's the thing. A lot of entrepreneurs send me their hot sauces, and I'm like, it's another hot sauce, man. Yeah. Like, what's different? And then the first time I tried yours, it's like, whoa, like that really tastes like coffee.
Yeah.
In a good way. Like, it's balanced and it still works out. You can put it on anything.
Yeah.
But like that, I think that's exciting. The hot chicken thing is super interesting, right? Like it used to be Minnesota. It's all ketchup is too hot for people here. And I think that's still largely true. But, you know, if 25% of the people are into spice, hey, that's enough. Like that's a good business.
Well, and I think part of it is just the younger generation is going, well, I can handle it. That's old Minnesota. No, I am a foodie. I have experienced all these different cultures of food. And then and then the real spice, they still dull it down in Minnesota. Yes. Than if so you go, I'll take the spiciest. Right. And they go, who's it for? No, we'll get them the spicy version.
Right, the quote-unquote spicy.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's true.
But really appreciate your time coming in here.
Yeah.
You've done so much to support small businesses, to support Fall. Even the charity run I regrettably did last year was so awesome.
It was so great.
To have you in my ear as I'm tweaking out about to go live on TV was a really nice calming presence. And right. I think what you're doing for the local food scene and business is really respectable, and your ability to report in that what I think is probably more challenging way of the bipartisan reporting. I think it's really cool what you're doing. And I'm honestly still kind of stunned you're here right now. Sometimes I sit across from people and go, what are you doing here?
Well, I'm just it is very humbling to still be like a middle-class kid who never thought he'd be interviewing governors and presidents and that sort of thing. And so I try very hard not to let the fame that I have or the following I feel is like it doesn't really belong to me. I'm just sort of renting it for now. Yeah. And so I want to use it as much as possible, to leave this community better at the end. So it's a pretty great privilege.
I think
that's pretty good.
That's a great way to view it, that this is all, it's rented.
And yeah.
I think that's a very truly humble way to think about it.
It's not unearned. I'm not saying I don't deserve it. You know, you have to work and you have to deserve and you have to earn it.
Yeah.
But you also have to be aware of the fact that a lot of this is because of other people's work.
Yeah.
Or because my work just happens to go out of that transmitter that sends Channel 4 into people's homes.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of it. If I were just doing this on closed circuit TV, I don't know if it would make a difference.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if there's a better way to end the episode than that. So I will end it like I do every other episode and say, have a nice day.